Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman, trying to get my guest. Hopefully we'll connect without any problem. My guest is Charlotte Dennis, and Charlotte wrote a book that is certainly important to me. I have not written a book about what she did, but I've certainly written an awful lot for a number of years on George Bush. And her book is titled The People Versus Bush. Well, you can pretty much imagine what the book is about. Charlotte is an investigative journalist. She's an attorney. She is the co-author of a book that I haven't read, but I remember the title. It's called Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson Rockefeller, and Evangelism in the Age of Oil. Well, the Rockefellers, oil, banks, you know, all that stuff. I've certainly written a little bit about that, including a little bit about Nelson. I mean, the whole clan, I think. The whole clan that mattered. Well, they all matter. Oh, my God, talk about an evil clan. Charlotte, are we connected by any chance? Not yet. I just sent her an email to alert her, so hopefully there'll be no problem. But during the eight Bush years, eight horrific years, that very sadly have continued seamlessly under Obama, heading on toward 2 years next January. The reason I call Obama Bush's third term, we're talking about awful crimes of all sorts, war crimes, crimes against the American people. And I'll have a later program in October talking about how for many decades America has been at war with Islam. I have to go on television this afternoon to talk about this, as a matter of fact, not in the U.S., outside of the country. They never let me talk about this in the country, but I will outside. And my thought is that before 9/11, it was an unofficial war. And I remember it as a boy growing up in the 1940s, films that vilified Arabs, but, you know, what's a 10-year-old kid know? Later on, I caught on who the good guys were and who the bad guys were, and the most important question of all, why? Well, we've vilified Muslim people, Arab people, and then it became official after 9/11. I have a new article out today on that, another topic, but we have been at war, and I'm working on a new article right now, specifically on one part of Fallujah. I've written an awful lot about Iraq. Talk about war crimes.
Charlotte's on.
Charlotte, are you on?
I'm here.
Oh, delighted. I was, maybe a little fearful that we got our time zones mixed up.
Oh, no, I'm here.
Let me just finish my one thought, then you jump into your book. I said I'm writing a new article on Iraq right now, and I've written an awful lot about it, and the last one I wrote was titled One of History's Greatest Crimes, and I'm talking about over the past 20 years.
Oh, that's
not just
great.
In 2003.
Where can I find it?
Well,
your website?
You could just Google my name and One of History's Greatest Crimes,
okay,
and you'll find it. Or if you go to my blog site, Steve Lenman Blog, you'll find it there along with all my other articles. I really mention my blog. I should mention it more often.
Yeah.
I just use it to store all my articles. But we want to talk about your book, Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I forgot to mention one thing about you in introducing you. You are running, you're an independent candidate, I guess, for Attorney General of Vermont?
I'm actually running on the Progressive Party ticket. We have a third party in Vermont that has major party status. We've got about five people already elected to the legislature. We've got a lot of candidates running. So we think of ourselves, as, and I think it's accurate that we're the most viable third-party movement in the country.
Oh, I certainly hope so. I by saying independent, I really meant a party or an affiliation other than the Democrats, who certainly aren't Democratic, and the Republicans, who certainly aren't Republican. I have other much more precise names for them. But your important new book, The People versus Bush, talk about the book.
Well, the book is based on a campaign that I ran 2 years ago, actually. And to make a long story short, a friend of mine had put a copy of Vincent Bugliosi's book in my hands, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. And she had said to me, you know, there's something about what the separate states can do. So I read through the book, and I landed on this one sentence, which said any attorney general or any DA can actually prosecute the former president in a state criminal court. And he laid out the evidence. He laid out how one could do this legally, the legal structure. And I was intrigued, and I wasn't running. I wasn't a sitting attorney general. I was running for it, and I just thought that if any state could help advance this cause, which is the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder and war crimes, it would be Vermont, because we have a huge animus against Bush. Still, I maintain we had lost the highest number of soldiers per capita in the war in Iraq. We had had over 30 towns vote to impeach in their town meeting George Bush. So I felt like the climate would be good. Also, in the town of Brattleboro, Vermont, they voted on a resolution to have Bush arrested if he ever even stepped foot into Vermont, or into Brattleboro. And that was sort of like a little shout that was heard around the country.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. Oh, that would have been I'm sure he wouldn't have come to Brattleboro unless he had a Marine division with him, shall it?
Well, he's never even been to Vermont, and some people, it's the only state he never visited.
Oh, my goodness. You mean he's been to Alaska, he went to Hawaii, but he never went to Vermont?
Never went to Vermont. And
I would say that alone is an impeachable offense.
Well, his supporters, I suppose, would say, well, therefore, how could you possibly prosecute Bush for murder if he never stepped into Vermont and never pulled a trigger and certainly never intended to kill Vermont soldiers? And so I explain the legal theories behind how he absolutely could still be prosecuted even though he never set foot in Vermont. One of the bases for that is that on a conspiracy charge, a conspiracy to commit murder, you do not need one of the co-conspirators to actually be at the scene of the crime. And all you have to show is that two or more people met and wanted to carry out an overt act that took place, say, in the state of Vermont. And one of the arguments for that is that Bush got on television in October 2002 and spread lies over the television about Saddam Hussein being a threat to our country, when he knew damn well that Saddam Hussein was not a threat. He had been informed by his intelligence agencies only the week prior to going on TV that the evidence basically was not in that he was a threat. There was questioning inside his own intelligence agencies as to the nature of the threat, but he just chose to disregard that. He wanted his pretext for going to war in Iraq and getting its oil. So, of course, he tried to link Saddam Hussein to 9/11 and also had a lot of people, gave authorization for torture of detainees in 2001 in the Afghan war. And the purpose of that torture was not to get actionable intelligence. The purpose of that early torture was to get them to confess to things that they actually didn't do. And one of them was to have ties to Saddam Hussein or 9/11. So you combine those two. It's pretty insidious. I would definitely agree with you. It's one of history's greatest crimes. And if we ever did have this trial in the United States, it would probably be one of the greatest crime trials in American history.
It sure would, Charlotte. And let me throw in one more thing. Not only did we know Saddam had no WMDs, we knew it back in the mid-1990s because Saddam, I'll remind listeners, I'm sure they remember this, Saddam's son-in-law defected to the West. You know, what was going on that made that happen, I don't know. But not only was he his son-in-law, he was in charge. Saddam was suspicious of people around him, and he only trusted important activities in government to people he really had explicit trust in. Mm-hmm. One of them was his son-in-law, apparently. His son-in-law was in charge of all of his weapons activities.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he knew what they had and what they didn't have, and he was obviously thoroughly debriefed, and he made it very clear that, no, there were no WMDs. Whatever they had left, and they certainly had no nukes. They had chemical weapons. I don't know if they had any biological weapons, but whatever they had, they basically got rid of it all before the Gulf War in 1991.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
The big part of that story was there were two or more feature stories in the New York Times about it. The New York Times, which meant it circulated across the country and it circulated around the world, and then after 9/11, that was all erased, airbrushed from history, and nobody mentioned it anymore.
Mm. Well, that's certainly very interesting. And, of course, we know what the New York Times subsequently did. It relied on Ahmed Chalabi
and Judith Miller.
Spreading the
talk about a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, and there's actually something in my book that I would wager that not a lot of people know. The book goes into, as I say, it goes into my race 2 years ago and how people reacted and the wonderful people I met in the impeachment movement and what we're calling the accountability movement. But it also gives an analysis of what happened after Bush left. Who's behind Obama, why is he carrying out the same foreign policy effectively, all of that. One of the things that I show in the book is that the plan, one of the reasons they wanted regime change in Iraq is because Saddam Hussein was opposed to building a new pipeline that would have connected Iraq with Haifa in Israel, on the coast of Israel. Iraq used to have a pipeline that fed directly to Haifa. And, in fact, that was one of the major prizes of World War I, was A, control of Iraq by the British, B, setting up a pipeline that carried the oil to Haifa. Haifa has a big refinery and was very important during World War II for supplying the Allied war machine. And but eventually, in the war of 1948, the War of Israeli Independence, it was closed and remained closed. And so I found documentation that the neocons had it all worked out with Israel that right after the invasion, they would start rebuilding that pipeline. And I have quotes in the book from the Israeli Minister of Infrastructure, from Netanyahu, who was then finance minister, and from, Haaretz was reporting on this, Asia Times was reporting on it. The whole idea was that the oil was going to flow. That's what they thought. Of course, they miscalculated. And the other part of the equation was that the person that was going to be the Iraqi head of state was someone who was in favor of the pipeline, and that was Ahmed Chalabi. Then Chalabi subsequently got caught lying and was basically shunted aside. But I think, from what I understand, that dream of a pipeline is still there. Israel wants to be an energy corridor on the eastern Mediterranean, and so people need to think about pipeline politics when they're trying to figure out the foreign policy in the Middle East.
Oh, absolutely. And pipeline politics is so central in Afghanistan, Charlotte.
Yep.
I mean, we're talking about the Caspian oil there. And,
yes, exactly. And I've been able to figure out that the stationing of troops coincides with the proposed pipeline route of the called TAPI, T-A-P-I, Trans-Afghan-Pakistan-India Pipeline. that's been in the works on the drawing board for just as long as the plan for the Iraq pipeline. And, yeah, so you'll see the route. I mean, I suggest people Google it. Google TAPI, look at the route of the pipeline, and then look at where all our troops are stationed. You know, I maintain that our troops are sent to areas to protect oil installations or pipeline routes. I've written about it in a book called Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Free Press, The Myth of the Free Press. And in it, I have an essay called The War on Terror and the Great Game for Oil, How the Media Missed the Context. And the reason I know all of this, that's a whole other story, but my father was involved in intelligence, counterintelligence, in the laying of the Trans-Arabian pipeline during World War II. And he came to a very untimely end in a plane crash in Ethiopia. I was just 6 weeks at the time. So I spent a lot of time researching the whole question of oil and pipelines.
Oh, well, if you wrote a book, Charlotte, you certainly have put a lot of research into it. It is no small feat to write a book, and you've written more than one. Have you written more than two? I mentioned the other one, but have you written more than two?
Well, I've written with my husband a book called Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon, Nelson Rockefeller and Evangelism in the Age of Oil.
I mentioned that in the introduction.
Yeah, that book took us 18 years.
Oh, my goodness.
We thought we were going to change the world. Ha ha. We embarked on that crusade in the age of Woodward and Bernstein when we all thought that they were just great and we were going to be great investigative journalists and we were going to have whole hearings about genocide of indigenous people in the Amazon and we were going to have a UN. These were our dreams that even to this day people don't understand that there was genocide in the Amazon. And what
There sure was, and
yeah.
I mean, there's genocide all over the world. I mean, there are multiple genocides ongoing right now in different parts of the world. They never stop.
Yeah, it's sad, and oftentimes, tragically, in this modern age of oil, oil is a culprit in the whole thing because the great game has gotten very vicious.
Because oil is
not going to be with us forever. And so it's an underground war, but sometimes it pops up into the surface. I say it's into the public eye. I say it's underground because, for instance, during World War II, here we were allies with the British and the French and the Russians. But I know, because I've gotten into my father's papers, I got them out of the National Archives, that the whole time he was spying on all of them. And the whole reason was, they had to safeguard Saudi oil. At all costs, quote unquote, and therefore it was a very vicious game even back then. I would dare say that my father was probably one of the first American victims of the great game for oil, but then it got into wars, and he had predicted in 1943, before he went to the Middle East, that he had said, God help us if we ever send troops into the Middle East, because he had known the history. He was a scholar on the subject. And his predictions have borne out.
Oh, absolutely. And I've written and I've said, and I believe, that there is no possibility in the end that we will prevail either in Iraq or Afghanistan. Both countries have a history. Afghanistan's longer than Iraq because before World War One, Iraq didn't exist. Iraq was literally created by the Brits and the French, and I don't know who else got a piece of it, but it was mainly the Brits and the French secondarily.
That's right.
And the Brits ended up with Iraq and Palestine, and they knew there was oil then. They just had no idea how much. I mean, that was, 1918.
Yeah, well, as far I traced it back, because I have been working on a book on the history of U.S. involvement in the Middle East, and you can trace it back to Churchill, who I think it was 1908 when he was first Lord of the Admiralty, which means he was in charge of the British Navy, and he made the conversion from coal to oil as the primary fuel of the military. And he realized that, as he said, he would have to face a sea of troubles by doing this, because Britain had lots of coal, but it didn't have any oil. So it required Britain to become, very imperialistic as it sought to gain control of oil supplies, and the oil of Iraq was a major target. It's hardly ever said in the history books. But that's the reality. If, you know, people think of what Lawrence of Arabia was all about. That was about the Brits defeating the Turks, part of the Ottoman Empire that had controlled all of the oil of the Middle East. And the Turks were allied with the Germans. And that was what the war was about. It was like getting rid of the Turks and making sure that the oil of Iraq could be secured for future use. And anyway, that's a whole other story.
Oh, absolutely. I think wars in general, Charlotte, resource wars, and the most treasured resource is oil because the world runs on it. And you're right, it won't last forever, but I think there's still an awful lot of it around.
I think you're right about that, by the way. I think I'm somewhat of like an iconoclast in that in my research in Thy Will Be Done, we came to learn that oil companies capped a lot of their wells. They just left them there because they wanted to exploit the oil of the Middle East first. And one of the reasons was because the Soviet Union hovered in the north of many valuable Middle Eastern oil fields. So the British thought we better get our hands on Middle Eastern oil first, and we'll go exploit that Latin American oil later, which they have done. But there's a lot of capping of wells all over the place, and there are new places opening up, like the Arctic, for instance. So, you know, we can't be sure. I mean, it is a depletable resource. But the other problem is, and this is something that most people, again, have never been taught, is that oil is the major fuel of the military. That's why we have a great game. That's why it's so vicious, and it's also why it's often hushed up, the oil angle, as a national security issue.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. And again, there's plenty in different parts of the world. Right in the Caribbean, there's a treasure trove of oil. But talk a little bit more about your book and some of the key points in the little time that we have left.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay.
Explain where you went and what you want to do, and if you have any key points, please go over those.
Well, the whole second part of the book, as I said, after I lost the election, I only had about 6 weeks to campaign the first time around. But one of the valuable things that I learned is that, there are people all over the country who care deeply about this whole question of accountability, and they're really sick of our leaders acting above the law. And they were highly disillusioned by the Democratic Party not doing an impeachment. And my book chronicles what happened in Vermont, because we had a real good chance of getting impeachment onto the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. Our Senate, our Vermont Senate, passed a resolution based on something that came out of the time. It's called the Jefferson resolution, or not resolution, but it's a old House rules still on the books that if a state wants to pursue impeachment proceedings, they can do it with a vote of their legislature. So Vermont did it. It got killed in the House. I know that top leaders of the Democratic Party put the kibosh on it, including Senator Patrick Leahy, the very powerful chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's a Vermonter from a tiny state, but he's a senator and he has a lot of power. I found out later that the same thing happened, I believe it was in Seattle. The folks in Seattle tried to do the same thing we did, and again, it was killed by the House. So I analyzed why that might have happened. Why is it that the Democratic Party didn't want to impeach? That's in the book. Then I move on to the fact that when Obama comes into power, when he said we need to move forward and not move backward, I've concluded that that was a signal, certainly to the CIA, who was criminally liable for the torture, and of course, going right up to the top of the White House, that he was not going to proceed with any kind of prosecution or criminal investigation. And, you know, you can't prosecute anyone if you can't deal with what they did in the past, right? I mean, it's ridiculous. So, but by saying that, he really tamped down a growing movement for accountability. Because when he won the election, the biggest issue on his campaign website was a criminal investigation into Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and the rest of them. And then he just kept tamping it down, unfortunately. And then we know that promises were broken on treatment of detainees. We've had actually strengthening of the use of the state secrets privilege to prevent victims of torture to having their day in court. And I do an analysis of who Obama is, and I will say for the record that he's backed by the Rockefeller Central Faction, if you like. They're back in power with Obama, and he was groomed by the Trilateral Commission. He was heavily supported by Jay Rockefeller, and I discuss it in the book. So people need to understand that that's why it's foreign policy as usual, although not as cowboyish as Bush's foreign policy. It's a lot more sophisticated, but still achieving America's imperial needs at this stage of advanced capitalism.
I would say cowboyish, Charlotte, in the sense that Bush would pump his fist, you know, the aircraft carrier stunt back in 2003, much more overt. But
yeah.
Obama's policies are not only the same, but he's expanded the wars, and I'll be discussing this later, going on an interview of me. Discussing this, I mean, he expanded into Pakistan, expanded into Yemen, expanded into Somalia. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on. But he's clever in the way he explains things or doesn't explain things. He's not in your face. He's more sophisticated.
Yeah, and that is the Rockefeller imprint. I know it well. I spent 18 years studying it. But the last thing I just want to say is twofold. Number one, Bush's book is coming out in early November after the elections, and my publisher is very eager to challenge bookstores that if you're going to put Bush's book in that bookstore, you need one that answers it. So I might ask callers to call their local bookstores and make sure that that happens. The publisher is Chelsea Green. I've had a virtual media blackout on my book. I've got great blurbs from people, from Howard Zinn to Naomi Wolf to Glenn Greenwald, great blurbs, very few reviews, and this is one way that we can also remind Democratic Party faithful who are dismayed that the Republicans might get back in, that this is a way of fighting back and reminding voters of just how horrible that Bush regime was. I mean, they practically destroyed our country. So you got to draw the line somewhere, and that's where I start. So that's number one. And the second thing is, I am running for Attorney General again. It's a much more Vermont-focused campaign, not only because a lot of people think, well, you know, Bush is gone and good riddance, although there's no statute of limitations on murder and war crimes. But the other thing is that we have huge issues here in Vermont, and I believe the Attorney General is quite vulnerable on them, and I need support. So, you know, chardennett.org is my website. 2 years ago, Vincent Bugliosi was going on radio shows and putting out his tin cup, and I was getting support from all over the country. And, folks, I need that support again. I am consistent in my message of accountability and transparency, and our biggest issue in Vermont right now is to close the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant that leaked radioactive strontium, tritium, and cesium into the soil and the water this winter. It's been a huge issue, and it continues to be probably one of the biggest issues of the campaign. And since the Attorney General is supposed to protect the health and safety of the people, I'm making it a major issue.
Charlotte, I can only dream of having a legion of attorney generals like you, not only in Vermont and other states, but sitting in Washington, D.C., attorney generals of the Ramsey Clark mold.
Yeah.
They broke that mold after him. Attorney generals who represent us and not the special interests who want nothing but harm to us. I'm sure you would go at it hammer and tongue. And if you elect a Democrat or a Republican, I'm afraid, you're going to get the other kind. We need an independent like you in the Progressive Party, Charlotte.
Well, I want to thank you so much. And I really appreciate everything that you're doing, because having your radio show and alternative media is crucial to keep the people informed. So you're doing great work.
Well, I try. a fair audience listens to this. It spreads out over the 50-state challenge. I have no idea how many people in Vermont listen, and anybody across the world can tune into this program because we're online, and the programs are archived, so you can be in Tibet and be a regular listener.
Yeah.
You might have a hard time listening live, but you don't need to. You can listen through archives, and I think all my listeners know that. The little listening I have time for, because I spend so much time writing, I listen to archives programs because I'm usually writing when something comes on live.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go, and it's a wonderful thing. It's true. I mean, thank God for community TV. I just had a debate with the incumbent earlier this week, and now I can send it all over Vermont.
Oh, that is absolutely wonderful. Charlotte, we are out of time. I wish we could continue, but I wish you absolutely the best of luck. Again, Charlotte Dennis and her important book, The People versus Bush.
Thanks
so
much.
What a crucial topic, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Many thanks for coming on.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks. And join us this weekend. Oh, two terrific programs coming up. We're on at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. I guarantee you two terrific programs coming on. I honestly try to make them all terrific. Vital topics, distinguished guests, in-depth discussions. You'll never get this on CNN or NBC or any of those. You know that. I don't have to tell you. Join us.